We've got resolutions this week to some of the problems from last week, which is a healthy feeling. The thing is that today, the group FaceTime problem is completely resolved now. So that's good news.
Apart from on the developer beta.
It's true. So
it doesn't really count, but
yeah, it doesn't really count. Unless on,
I mean, this is like the perfect example of the separation of standard and beta channels, right? There's, you know, you have the public features, and then you have the developer train, and it took them a while to get it out to the public, and then the beta is even further behind. But that's the deal. That's the contract you sign with the devil when you're on the beta train. Is that, you know, critical security? You're not supposed to use beta operating systems on your main devices anyway. Like you're meant, theoretically, you're meant to have entirely separate devices that you use that you only put the betas on, and you only use it to test, you know, your own software. But obviously that doesn't happen. But yeah, obviously it's not a complaint that they haven't got it out on the developer train. But we did obviously see a new developer beta next week. We'll get to later.
Yeah. So today we get iOS 12.1.4 as an officially released iOS update. There was no beta to this at all. Just here it is. And there's also a macOS 10.14.3 supplemental update. And I think both of those are primarily about this FaceTime fix. Although the iOS one at least includes a few more software updates that we can get to in a moment. But since last week, so we got the release today. It was expected last week because, like, in the initial response to the FaceTime eavesdropping bug thing, where you can call someone and then call yourself and then hear what the other person is saying before they pick up, Apple said we're gonna fix it by the end of the week. And then at the end of the week, it was like last Friday, they said it'll be ready next week. We fixed it at the server side, and the iOS update will be ready next week. So they bought some more time. And they also apologized. I mean, I think last week we highlighted the fact, and a lot of people did, that Apple hadn't said sorry for this yet. And in that update to the press, at least, they said sorry to the customers. So, yeah. It was a nasty episode, but they've done a lot of damage control, at least since like getting caught off guard with what happened. Part of it is that in the security notes for the update, they include the Thompson family or the teenager's name, Grant Thompson, and then Apple sent a statement to the press, including us, saying that, you know, he will be eligible for the bounty program, or his family will be compensated for finding it. And then they also said, without quoting, but I just kind of on background, but it's from Apple, that they're going to help pay for his education. So it's a nice thing.
Yeah, it is a bit, I think it does highlight obviously some, not injustices, but odd things that Apple needs to straighten out regarding how they manage bugs and payouts and stuff of the sort, because the bug bounty program, as it is at the moment, is technically meant to be invite only, and technically only applies to select categories. But maybe if you're a well-known figure, then you can get in maybe on like a backhand handshake, and you kind of have to, you know, make these weird relationships. It's a weird contrast to other tech companies which have more open, you know, bug reporting systems, where if you believe that you found a bug that classifies for a reward, you can just go on a website and submit it, and then it'll get reviewed and fixed, and the due process carries out from there. And then here, it's like Apple's like, ooh, we kind of have a bug bounty program for certain people, but it turns out maybe we're a bit more, you know, we spread the net wider when we find certain things, or we have people that we like, but we don't want to make it official. They didn't even really announce it at WWC originally. The bug bounty program was done at some like hacker conference, right? And then there's not like a website for it, because before the show I was trying to just check a couple of things, and it's like if you search Apple bug bounty program, there are no results. Like the closest you get is a Apple page that just says report bug fixes on radar or email product security. Like there's no, from what I can find, formal acknowledgement that it properly exists. So it's all still a bit like, almost they're just kind of trialing it out for, but it's been 2 years at this point and it's not concretely set down.
Its origin is kind of in response to other companies have bug bounty programs that pay a lot more, but this was like Apple responding to criticism of them having zero program, and so they kind of do like the least they can do. And in this case, it's just it's the publicity around the bug and the fact that as a teenager, like if it was not a teenager or like a non-technical mom in a situation, like if it was just like me or you, this wouldn't happen. But because the balance of like this kid should be like it was the family was ignored when they tried to tell Apple about the problem. They deserve something for their time and troubles. And, you know, then Apple has to go like above and beyond. And then also not only like say, yes, you can be in the program. And there was, I think CNBC said that an Apple executive at some level went to this house to like meet with the family. And then they'll also pay for some education, some schooling. Like it's all undisclosed amounts, but, you know, that's like an over. It's like, you've got to react more than if it was just like a normal bug bounty program with normal rules and you know, public facing.
Yeah, obviously this thing spiraled way out of control because of problems that Apple, you know, the way Apple behaved. But even compared to other, you know, major issues we've had in the last few years, this one definitely hit mainstream media a lot more and a lot more people were aware about it. Like, my family was telling me about it at the dinner table the other day and I was like, yeah, I kind of made that happen in directly.
Yeah, for your coverage, yeah.
Which they never understand, but it is kind of funny that. And I still want to kind of, I think it's, we still have not quite got the full picture on everything here because the source of the coverage that, you know, that I did 2 weeks ago now was based on a different viral tweet that wasn't related to Grant Thompson at all. So
right.
I don't know if the Thompsons at some point were just telling all their friends that what this, because obviously they posted on Facebook and stuff, so maybe it spread that way and somehow it ended up at this, someone ended up videoing it separately. So there's still parts of the story. It's like a movie. It's like there's still scenes that haven't been released.
Yeah, because they had a YouTube video, but it was unlisted. It was just to show Apple, I think. But you couldn't search on YouTube for like FaceTime bug or Apple bug or anything like that because it was unlisted. Like even after we saw that the video existed, we couldn't find it to embed it in a story or anything like that because it was just there as a medium to show Apple on video, I guess. But yeah, and in the security document for the fix for iOS 12.1.4, they credit the Thompson family and someone else from Texas. So it's like, and the report was duped. So like maybe it wasn't Apple that duped it, but maybe it was this other person from Texas, like this other party that discovered the same thing. I don't know.
And as part of the kind of delay in releasing the update because they said it was going to come last week and it came this week. In a statement, they said they've, in the meantime, conducted a full security audit of the FaceTime service on the software side and their servers. And as part of these updates, they actually include another fix, which they've discovered for some sort of live photos vulnerability, which they don't detail what the problem was, but because they don't give a firm description, I assume it has to be pretty bad because they've also disabled live photos on non-updated devices in addition to group FaceTime. So, and if you, the live photos timeline's kind of funny because they had it for 1v1 and then they took it away with iOS 12 originally.
Right.
And then it came back in 12.1.1. And so if you happen to still be on 12.1.1, you now won't be able to use live photos forever. Obviously, most people are on 12.1.1 would then update to 12.2 and 12.1.4 and eventually 12.2 and stuff. So it's a very small sliver of the customer base that is really going to be like, oh, I want to stay on the old operating system and I have lost these features. Because it's the main reason nowadays where people like stay on older versions is if there's, for some whatever reason, a jailbreak came out that people want to stay on, but that hasn't happened for iOS 12. So, you know, that like niche doesn't really exist.
You would only stay on it in the hopes that some iOS 12 version gets in that camp. And that's like a whole other world anyway. And you give up, like you forego security in exchange for whatever you get.
Yeah, exactly.
And the statement they gave us, they say, I'll read it here. They say, today's software update fixes the security bug in group FaceTime. We again apologize to our customers and we thank them for their patience. In addition to addressing the bug that was reported, our team conducted a thorough security audit of the FaceTime service and made additional updates to both the FaceTime app and server to improve security. Like you said, this includes a previously unidentified vulnerability in the live photos feature of FaceTime to protect customers who have not yet upgraded to the latest software. We have updated our servers to block the live photos feature of FaceTime for older versions of iOS and macOS. So I wonder if it's just like you could take someone's picture on FaceTime without
discreetly.
Yeah, just like without the alert coming up somehow. I don't
know. 'Cause the live photos thing tell you, for a start, you have to allow permission. Like there's a setting where you can stop the other end party from taking a live photo of you through FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And then when you do take one, it tells the person that you've been taking a photo of.
Yeah.
So it's more communicative than, you know, like taking a screenshot.
Yeah.
However, if you want to be more cynical about that statement, the company that's, you know, arguably the biggest company in the world and talks about privacy and security to the nth degree, why was a thorough security audit not conducted earlier?
And it was required
before the feature came out, even.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you would think that at some level there's always a team responsible for this kind of thing internally. And I guess you can't audit everything all the time. There's just like, as it's being developed and you miss things and the audit is just like, let's take a comb over to make sure that we're not missing anything. And there was a thing like where, Congress was sent a formal letter to Apple asking questions about the FaceTime bug. And in part of that, they ask, were there any other undisclosed bugs that you know about that you haven't told customers? Because their whole thing is they want to know what Apple knows and when they knew it and when customers were alerted. And this kind of falls in the category. It's like there was something else. And then now they've disclosed it. And, you know, they're probably trying
Which probably they didn't actually know about earlier.
Right. They knew and about they just, once they did this audit.
And realistically, I expect that what happened was, as in the run-up to iOS 12's release, obviously they have people, you know, QA and security teams check over stuff, and especially privacy inside Apple is such a big thing that any new features have to get like ticked off by this dedicated privacy group that, as people in the past have heard, like privacy czars, that they can literally cut features on and leave them on the cutting room floor entirely if they don't meet certain requirements about user data and stuff like that. And they're always pushing to make, you know, the teams that actually do features to require less and less data. And that obviously, those processes obviously happen with FaceTime and everything else. But probably in light of all the media attention, they took like their entire security resources and with a fine tooth comb through the entire FaceTime system, which if they, it would just be unrealistic for them to do that for the entire OS all the time, I assume.
And there's, like, I guess no one made them do the security audit for FaceTime, and it is the right thing to do, but that's not necessarily doesn't guarantee that they would do that. So it's, you know, kudos for doing the FaceTime security audit. It's the obviously right thing to do and smart thing to do, but they didn't have to, and so it's smart that they did, you know.
It's definitely covering their tracks, because can you imagine if, like, next month someone else found a terrible FaceTime bug that did a similar
Now, in the security document where they talk about the fix, this always happens. I mean, when we had the HomeKit incident, it's like if you didn't know the internals of, like, what was happening, you wouldn't know from the fix description whatever happened. And it's kind of the same thing here. They say FaceTime impact, the initiator of a group FaceTime call may be able to cause the recipient to answer. That's not exactly what would happen. Like, they didn't know they answered. It just showed that you declined the call, you know? I mean, it's a way of describing it, but it's not quite as bad as it sounds, as it really was. And then they say, description, a logic issue existed in the handling of group FaceTime calls. The issue was addressed with improved state management. And then who they credit is the teenager Grant Thompson of Catalina Foothills High School. And then the second person is David Morris of Arlington, Texas. So that's as much exposure as they get there. I also saw people complaining on Twitter to us that the apology from last week and then that would carry over to the one from today is not a like on Apple.com, for example. Like there have been letters from Tim Cook and, you know, apologies for Maps kind of thing. There's nothing on like Newsroom about this. It's just private statements given to the press, and you got to rely on like reading the press coverage to see the apology. What do you think about that? That sometimes Apple does publicly apologize, and something you can find on their website. But for this, there's been like nothing except for the software update security document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way that I would distinguish that, and obviously this is all very subjective, right? And I'm sure they discuss putting stuff on the website or not. And sometimes they're legally required to post stuff on the website. Like I remember, there was some that the iBooks price fixing thing that as part of the settlement for that, they had to write on Apple.com, the homepage, a line about the price fixing scandal and here you can claim and complain and stuff. And that was on their website for like 2 months or whatever. Mm-hmm. obviously, in these cases, they have to do certain reporting, especially now under GDPR regulations. They have to tell certain groups, but there's nothing that forces them to report it on their own site. However, I think where they would draw the line is if they had decided to do something that turned out to be bad versus them always having good intention along the way, and obviously a bug happened.
Yeah.
Because I think the problem with thing with maps is it wasn't like maps came out and there was a big bug with it. Like, it was, no, Apple chose to release the maps product in the way they did. It pre-installed, replacing the old maps app, and they signed off it with their Apple, you know, this is good enough. And obviously it wasn't, and that caused a massive furore at the time. And so that's where you see like the Apple.com public letter, because it's similar to like the investor letter, where it's like, we made these decisions that were clearly incorrect, so we're apologizing at that level. For bugs, I don't think that it really needs that kind of thing, because it's the distinction between, you know, being a company that's focused on privacy and being a company that's focused on privacy and, you know, messing up occasionally. Like, that's where I kind of draw the distinction. That's why I'm not upset that they didn't, that it's not on permanent record on the Apple site. For this type of thing, I think it's actually appropriate. They notified newsrooms and stuff, and then I think that's sufficient.
Yeah, and I can imagine in a public forum, like some conference, you know, coming up, that somebody from Apple, again, makes an apology. And, like, again, it isn't on Apple.com, but it's like you at least acknowledge what happened. Because they did that with the old iOS 8.0.1 incident, where you update and then you lose Touch ID and cellular access on your device. there was no apology for that. And that feels like a pretty similarly bad thing, like, you know, especially if you rely on your device for connection to the internet, which is not unheard of. And you know, I'm sure they apologize in, like, you know, press statements, but not press releases. And then it was Jaws, who was on stage at a Recode conference and acknowledged it there. So yeah, that makes sense to me.
And you have the current talk to the hand air power response.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it. Like, if it's a problem to not apologize and an official capacity or like public facing or not, but I think that
the battery program is a good comparison, right? Because that was them intentionally deciding to do performance management in a specific way, and then they chose not to write it up at the time, and then later when that blew back in their face, they did actually have, you know, Apple support articles explaining everything, explaining their reasoning and telling people what to do about it. So I think that's another example of the distinction of them intentionally making choices that they then, you know, not backtrack on, but apologize for and explain and kind of back up with their own words versus, you know, press statements from anonymous, quote unquote, Apple spokespeople for bugs.
Yeah. This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by our friends at Hyper. This month, we've teamed up with Hyper for our first ever 9to5 Mac Deal of the Month, where we'll feature a great deal on quality accessories for Apple devices. For February, you can get the new Hyper Juice wireless charging case for AirPods for just $20, down from the usual $50 price tag. That's a great value for adding wireless charging to your existing AirPods. This is a new and improved second generation version of Hyper's wireless charging case, featuring a fully enclosed design and other improvements. Just insert the original Apple AirPods charging case inside the new Hyper Juice case, and you can wirelessly charge your AirPods with any Qi charger, just like your iPhone. And it has a design and look similar to the original case that comes with AirPods without being too bulky or looking cheap or added on. You can charge Apple's AirPods case back to full in just 1.5 hours, and a green LED will let you keep an eye on the charging status. Head to the show notes to get the Hyper Juice wireless charger case for AirPods for 60% off, making it just $20 for 9to5 Mac Happy Hour listeners. Our thanks to Hyper for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, the FaceTime bounty issue isn't the only thing that's in the news this week. There was a Mac security issue that you covered, and in this case, the person who found it is not telling Apple how it was done, because even if he was invited, there's just no mechanism for a Mac bug to be rewarded. And it takes a lot of work for the people to find them. And so to protest, this person is just not telling Apple how he found what the bug is precisely. Tell me the details there.
Yeah, so this kind of feeds into what we were talking about before the break, in that the current Apple bug bounty program is very built on foundations of jelly. They have this kind of rough guideline thing, but maybe if you can sweet talk someone, you can get in anyway. But technically, they only give out rewards for certain specific categories of iOS vulnerabilities and iCloud vulnerabilities, finding a way to escape the app sandbox on iOS or accessing user data from iCloud that obviously you're not supposed to. There is currently not an official macOS bug bounty program. Some issues that affect the Mac also affect iOS because they have shared foundations, but if you're finding Mac-specific problems, you technically cannot get any money at all.
Right.
And so what this security researcher, Linus Hines, has done is he's released a video purporting to demonstrate a exploit with the macOS keychain where you can get user passwords from the login and system keychains without having to do anything, essentially, apart from download a malicious app. Mm-hmm. You don't need admin privileges. You don't need to have any special configurations. Like a default installed macOS would be susceptible to this. But he's not telling anybody how he did it, and he's not disclosing it to Apple as a kind of protest that he thinks it's unfair that he can't actually get any money for this.
Right.
And he's not, on the scale of ethical disclosure, at the one end you don't tell anybody and you sell it to these Chinese companies that hack people left, right, and center.
Right.
And then at the other end of the spectrum. Yeah, literal criminals, essentially. And then you kind of have the Apple bug bounty program in the middle, and then on the very far right, you have, I just disclosed to Apple, I'm not even interested in money, and I just want to get this stuff fixed, so I file a radar, I wait 3 months, and then Apple releases the update, and then I tell people how I did it after it's all resolved,
right.
Because that's the ideal process where nobody actually, you don't tell people how you did it until the company has time to roll out the update. Yeah. And you can coordinate with the company and it all works well. Apart from in cases where it breaks down, like what we saw with the FaceTime problem. This, I would say, is obviously it's not the most well-meaning approach, but it's by no means the worst. I think it's fine, right? if you want people to get paid for their work, sometimes they have to strike about it. Sure. So sometimes you have to kick up a fuss. And as long as he doesn't tell nefarious actors what is going on here, I'm not going to feel bad against him. And although he hasn't released definite proof that he does have this exploit under lock, he does have a credible history of releasing iOS exploits through, a proper disclosure to Apple, and he has even credits in previous security release notes. So it's generally believed that he's not just making this up.
He's someone with experience who could reasonably have discovered this, right?
Yeah. And I think it just highlights a problem. It's Apple has iOS, Apple has macOS, and they aren't showing confidence, essentially, in the security of one platform because they don't have bug bounty rewards backing it up.
Yeah, and it's not that Apple couldn't afford to pay out for these things. And is there any harm in a well-funded bounty program? All I could think of is that you just like the risk is you encourage people to find things, but that's the whole point of it.
That's the point.
The strong argument is I can't think of one. It's just you're not really paying for hostages because as long as you're telling Apple the right way, no one's harmed. There is Apple's problems that you're solving and you're doing the work for them. Apple internally didn't find these things. They could, but they didn't. And, it affects all customers. So I can't think.
Yeah. And it's not bug bounty programs are rare or kind of, up and coming. They're very well established, across the industry, and they make sense. It's hard to make an argument against them, not existing. Apple certainly has the money to support it because even the biggest claims are $200,000.
To not support this type of work with a proper bug bounty program, either one on iOS that's well funded or one in the Mac that even exists at all, is like it kind of cloudies the people that find the bugs. Because if you're not going to credit them well and compensate them for their work, then it's like Apple takes the same position of they might as well just be a hacker, like someone who's doing this maliciously. And it's like, it actually is not malicious to find the flaws in the code that exists and that are expected to exist, you know, and this is just part of the process. It's like, it's only malicious once you abuse what you found. And in these cases, like, these people are, you know, as an uncommon and rare expertise, they're able to find these things, and it makes some perfect sense to me that they should be compensated fairly for them. And like you said, like, the comparison to a strike, like, if you're working and a job and you're able to strike for better, you know, circumstances, like, you think something's unfair about what you do, and you're able to say, like, look, you can't just replace us with anybody else, so we're not going to do the work until you meet our demands. As long as there's some middle ground agreement to be had, then I think it's natural. And in this case, this is, you know, there were some people who said this guy is holding back information that could harm people if it was discovered. Otherwise, he needs to do the right thing and just give it over for free. But that's kind of been the precedent so far, and that hasn't helped much. And I think there is a clear need, like, that this as a thing that exists outside of Apple. You know, people discover bugs and give them to Apple. Security bugs, then that deserves to exist, because there's been a need shown for it. That Apple, even with their, you know, their value as a company, they can't possibly be expected to find all these things on their own. It doesn't work.
Yeah, and if they want to tout, you know, privacy and security, mm-hmm. then this bug bounty program seems like a great way to be able to reinforce that. It's like, you pay some people when they find problems. You don't pay people when they don't find an issue. Like, it feels very fair. It's hard to argue against it. And if Linus Hynes was, you know, like, doing these protests because he was upset that he wasn't getting paid $300,000, not $200,000, or
yeah,
like, if it was more on those technicalities, then I'd feel less, you know, supportive of his public act.
Right.
But the literal fact is, you know, he's done, you know, clearly good work, and he's found a problem, and he just wants to be paid for it. And it doesn't seem, there doesn't seem to be any argument for Apple not offering a bug bounty program for Mac when they do for iOS. And I think it's just a matter of they haven't got around to it, but they've taken their sweet, sweet time. And you know how you hurry up stuff that's taking the sweet, sweet time? You do public acts like this to get attention.
Sure.
Yeah. In the same way as the FaceTime. It's a very similar corollary to the whole FaceTime thing that actually caused, you know, results. And now it seems like Apple is actively reviewing their internal policies and how they, you know, on bug reporting overall. So you actually get a positive outcome, and you have to do this kind of annoyance in the middle where you know, maybe expose some problems slightly prematurely. But, like, he's known to Apple in the past. He's collaborated with them before on iOS problems. I very much expect that he asked ahead of time, you know, to the right people, hey, can I get a bug bounty reward for this? And they've clearly told him no. So, you know, what's his options? He can either not get paid, or he can, you know, make a little public stunt about it. And I can't argue against that at all.
I wonder what would be cheaper, a bug bounty program or hiring the people that want a bug bounty program? Like, an annual salary and benefits, or just like a one-time fee to Apple to the free.
Well, I mean, an annual salary is way more than $200,000.
That's what I would think. And in that case, because they have hired some people before, like, to work on security teams.
You know, and they do have a security team. Yeah, like, don't get me wrong.
Like, based on people finding things, oh, you found things, you know, come work for us, or recruit you.
Just think of how many attacks Apple faces on a daily basis, whether it's against their servers, it's against their devices, all of the black box, gray box, you know, USB restriction mode, all of that stuff, and everything that you just never hear about. Like, they will have attempts to hack into their databases, whether it's, you know, AppleCare, Apple Store, or iCloud, every minute of the day. Like, not even, like, literally every minute of the day. There'll be people trying all this stuff. And all of that stuff happens behind the scenes, and they, you know, deal with it 99% of the time correctly. But the 1% slice is where you have this kind of fallback of a bug bounty program, because you entice people to go to Apple rather than go to, you know, some nefarious company that will pay you $1 million, but that's very black market. So you can be legitimate about it and get paid a decent sum and actually help make the platform secure for you know, the entire world. But yeah, like a one person hiring will be easily more than $200,000 in terms of salary and compensation
for
and stuff.
1 year. So, yeah, and it's not guaranteed to have you know,
results,
right? Like, yeah. So it seems economical to me to have a bug bounty program, and the invite only thing, it kind of makes no sense to me either. Like on iOS, I guess the idea there is they're filtering out too many submissions. And like having their own class of like what they take seriously, but that's proven not to be very effective.
I would expect that at some point they do plan on actually having like a normal bug bounty program, and this is still kind of their trial period. But that's what they sprung up, you know, in 2016, 2017, and now it's 2019, and they haven't actually done it. They haven't actually got there. They haven't actually done the process of setting, you know, up a registration form and a support thing. Like, just look at Radar. Look how old Radar is. Like, you know, clearly there's admin and stuff involved. And I'm sure when they're not, I can't fathom any logical reason why they wouldn't want to have a proper institutionalized program in place. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things where it's been on the to-do list and they haven't got there. And, you know, a protest might just push it up the to-do list in terms of priority.
I mean, the only thing I can imagine is if they just think that they're good enough on their own, they don't need it. But that's proven to be, you know, dumb-minded.
Yeah, and wrong countless times.
Right. So, you know, suck it up and say, we accept outside help. We'll pay for it.
And I know this stuff isn't very interesting in terms of, you know, products and, you know, iOS software, like, it's not the most interesting thing I talk about either. Like, I'm not going to deny it, but this stuff is important to, you know, and it is incredibly relevant to the company. So,
yeah, I mean, like, zoom out, and it would be nice to have avoided the entire FaceTime bug story. Like, you know, it should be the discussions of like how FaceTime, group FaceTime is used, and like how, you know, I mean, we discussed last year, like, actually how nice the feature is and like how reliable it is. Like, since it launched, you know, AirPlay 2 is late, it's reliable. Group FaceTime was late, it's reliable. It's like, those are topics that we like to have, not the ones where like the whole thing fell apart and Apple's not managing it very well, you know, so.
Yeah, but it'd be wrong to ignore it.
Yeah, totally. What's the situation this week with iOS apps kind of abusing privacy and what's going on there?
Yeah, so TechCrunch shared this story that was like, some iPhone apps are recording the screen of your iPhone without customers knowing, without users knowing.
Okay.
What it means is apps often include analytics frameworks that record the current app that you're in. So they can't see what you're doing in other apps. But I'm just going to use, let's just use the 9to5 Mac app, not to use any names, right?
Good app.
Theoretically, we could put an analytics framework in the 9to5 Mac app that logs what you do when you're going from screen to screen. And then along with the logs, it can have little videos, which are essentially like repeated screenshots, because the iOS system doesn't really let a developer take a screen recording completely. So it's not like the control center feature. So what these frameworks do is they essentially just take screenshots, you know, a few times a second. And when you put a load of pictures together, it looks like a little video. So you have a low frame rate per second video of just what the user's doing. And it stores them on the phone. And then periodically it uploads them to the servers, which the developer can then look at. And the idea is, oh, this user tried to go into the settings to adjust the notifications feature, but they got lost and they didn't realize what they were doing. And maybe the UI should be clearer here. So we can watch their recording, see where they got stuck, and then we'll send that off to our product team to work on it and iterate and try and make something better. Mm-hmm. That is the idea. What TechCrunch highlighted is they highlighted this and made it more public, because although it is by no means hidden in the developer space, like, this is what these frameworks have, this is like their headline features, like, you can record what customers do and make your products better, it clearly isn't well known to users, which is a problem. But it's not, for me, and they specifically showed examples where these videos would record people typing in like their payment information, and so then credit card details would get sent off in video form to these companies inadvertently. And, you know, that is problematic. But there are plenty of ways for all of these apps to do analytics. Every website you go on does analytics, and I promise you, 95% of all apps that you use do incredibly fine-grained analytics that you are never aware of. I'm not saying it's right, but it happens. And I don't think you should be too freaked out that a developer knows you're on one screen, then you go to another screen, then you click on here, and you go somewhere else. Like, it probably is covered by some random clause in a privacy policy somewhere. But at the end of the day, you're using the application, they know what's going on. Like, the whole, when you're on Facebook or when you're, you know, browsing the web, you know, targeted ads use the exact same concept. It's just, in this case, the idea is it's only used to, like, enhance and make the product better. And then it's the same reason why, like, crash logs get sent to developers so they can find the crashes and fix them. I think it's, like, scary and maybe, but there's not really, like, I don't think there's much of a threat in the scheme of things here. It's just kind of like, it sounds, the headline makes it sound worse than the actual problem is, if that makes sense. Like,
what are the opt-in controls for this like? Like, I mean, I think that the initial thing is that users didn't know that this was happening to this level of detail, like that you can,
yeah,
you know, but what are the, is this like an iOS system level control that you have access to? Or is this like where you share information with developers at an iOS level? Or is it?
There is essentially nothing you can do.
Okay.
To stop it from happening.
Okay.
Because it's completely controlled by the application itself. And so any application that talks to a server could theoretically be sending user events in those server requests, right? Whether it's actually videos or whether it's just a log of, you know, Zach clicked on this button, then he clicked on this button, then he logged in, and then he bought something, and then he logged out. Because essentially, that's just a more compact form of uploading a video of the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And trust me, the text logs happen everywhere. Like, that is completely commonplace. And all these A-B testing that you see on Twitter and all these other apps, you know, at the ultimate, what's happening there is that they do A-B tests and then they record and see which one's converted best from all of these log events. And then they choose the one that converted best. So it is across the industry done. You cannot like it, but that's what happens. There is a slight wrinkle in that if you're on Android, you could install a app that kind of watches all network traffic.
Right.
And so theoretically, you could be notified when apps are doing this, when they're contacting third-party websites.
Or
when they're contacting
on the Mac,
servers.
For that matter. You could...
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can get those apps on the Mac as well.
Yeah.
But iOS's security, you know, sandbox model doesn't let those kind of apps happen.
Right.
So maybe you could do something weird with a VPN, but in general, basically can't do anything apart from not use the applications,
right.
Which is hard. It's not a great situation to be in, but there's not really anything Apple could really enforce about it because you can't, like, it's just network traffic at the end of the day. Like, there's nothing really specific. They already don't let developers take, like, clean videos of the screen, and obviously it's always contained to the application you're in. They can't see you go to multitasking or go to messages or do anything else.
Right.
It's only within, and while the application is foregrounded. So if you actually want to crack down on it, you can only really do it by policy, by, like, writing in the app review guidelines that you're not allowed to use these kind of frameworks anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that's hard to actually do
enforce.
Mechanically and enforce. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, as a user, it does sound creepy to me. And as someone who has to, like, for example, beta test apps, like just like pre-release versions of apps, I sometimes get freaked out using them long term because I don't know how much the developers can see of, like, if I'm using their app or not even at all, like what version I'm on and that kind of thing. And so I tend to shy away from, like, test flight apps for too long, unless it's, like, just to try it out before a story goes out. And again, like, I could, it's just like, it's what I don't know that kind of scares me there. But I just get the sense that, like, if it's a pre-release app, then there's probably more shit with the developer than if it's just an app on the App Store. But it sounds like even if it's an app on the App Store,
yeah,
there's enough with analytics that you just can't do anything about it.
Yeah. This practice, whether it's actual videos or whether it's just, you know, log events, mm-hmm. is insanely pervasive. I would even expect that Apple does it for their own apps on some of them, especially stuff like Apple Music. Like, they will have the kind of conversion rates information, they will, because it's just, like, business sense. And it sounds, I think it's one of those things that sounds a lot creepier than it really is if you actually think about it. Because it's like, they know that I've used this app and I've gone to this screen and this screen. But like that's, but it, the same way, you, they couldn't, like, say if you, say if you're on Twitter and you've got notifications and you've got your main timeline, right? You can record a log of they click notifications and then they click timeline. But if they didn't record the log, they still could work that out because they have to do like server requests to load the information for the mentions and the timelines and the main feed. Like when you follow someone on Twitter, you know, the servers have to know about it somewhere along the line. So it's not really giving them that much more information than they really could work out already. It just kind of does it in a way that's a lot easier to manage. So it's one of those things where it's, I generally think it sounds worse than it is. And the whole video practice is problematic, especially in cases where, you know, you're asked to take in credit card details and there's actually someone videoing you. And these frameworks do have mechanisms for like blacking out text fields and stuff. But the point of the TechCrunch article is that they found some apps that didn't do it properly. So this would be inadvertently uploaded, which is definitely bad. But at the end of the day, if you're typing in credit card information to buy something, someone somewhere has to know the credit card information for it to buy it. So, like, there's definitely statute of limitations on, like, realistically, if you want these apps to function at all, they do have to know this information, otherwise they just can't work.
Right.
So it's definitely, like, a thing that you have to, like, chew over, I think. And if you try and think about it sensibly, not with, like, the square quotes privacy, which is so trendy at the moment, is not as bad as it sounds. It could be better, and I definitely think there needs to be, like, probably an opt-in. Do you want your screen to be recorded to help make the app better? Yes and no. And that would be better than the current situation where people just do it and don't tell anybody.
No one would opt into that either. I don't think you don't really want to support the developer. Like I opt into,
which is realistically why it doesn't happen.
Yeah,
that's like they don't ask you because they know a lot of people say no. But making that a system policy is nigh impossible.
Sure. So I think about this like in the analog world, and the closest thing I can think of to like my credit card being exposed out there is like if I'm paying a dinner bill and I give the server my credit card to go off and run on a machine somewhere else, like out of sight. You know, in theory, they could capture the credit card information down, including the number in the back of the card. And then, you know, if they needed to like guess my zip code, if it was local, it wouldn't be very hard. And then you've got enough to like make transactions online. And then, you know, as a consumer, like the credit card gives you some protections that you know, even a debit card wouldn't. But it's just like, it's just a risk of like, you know, commerce, I guess. And that applies here too. It's a little bit different, but I was thinking in the real world, does my credit card number get exposed? And it often would in times where, yep, I'm paying someone and they take my card away from me, you know, and I don't get creeped up by that, but I guess it's just like the digital, if you don't expect it, then it's even creepier than if you knew about it. And this just exposed something that wasn't widely known about for consumers, at least.
Yeah. If you just take like, here's probably the best analogy I can think of. If you're just a reader, right, and you logged into 9to5 Mac to write a comment, right, I could phrase a headline like 9to5 Mac is watching everything you do, because we can know, you know, what pages you visit, because we have to load the pages for you to see them, right? It's like, how else could you, can't do it anywhere else. Like you have to associate the device with an account so they can leave a comment and be the same user every single time, and then you have to load pages, and we know, you know, which pages get how many views and everything else. So like, it's definitely one of those things that you can kind of spin it, I think. And there are obviously some legitimate problems with this kind of revelation, but I think there are way worse things to worry about in the world than this specific problem. Because I don't think on the scale it actually means that much realistically.
In the meantime, there is news on this just now. I'm as a recording, I see on Twitter, TechCrunch has published a news story that says, just in, Apple has told developers to remove screen recording code from their iOS apps, or their apps will be removed from the App Store. So they're going to try and enforce this in some way. We'll see how that goes. But it sounds like you think that it's not very enforceable, and they're going to try to enforce it just by threat, I guess.
Yeah, I can't think of a way for them to systematically do it, because the screenshot, you might ask, why does they let you screenshot the screen, right? The reason that exists is so that an app can do animations. Because if you want to do a full screen transition from one state to another, you have to be able to take an image of the screen that you can then, you know, render into, you know, fold up into a million pieces or fade out or whatever else. So, like, there are technical hiccups where it's, you can't really stop it. It's kind of like location services, right? Obviously, with location services, the system can make you show a pop-up that says allow location services, but in that little alert, you have to write the reason for why you're getting location, right? You have to say, this weather app needs your location to give you local weather. But as soon as you press allow, there's no way for Apple to know if you're actually using the location for that purpose.
Right.
And we even covered this a few weeks ago where they were getting sent off to advertisers and tracking your location around. So it's one of those things where it's like, yes, Apple can say, don't do this or we'll remove you, but you can't really stop anybody.
Yeah, this is their statement to TechCrunch. They say, protecting user privacy is paramount in the Apple ecosystem. Our App Store review guidelines require that apps request explicit user consent and provide a clear visual indication when recording, logging, or otherwise making a record of user activity. We've notified the developers that are in violation of these strict privacy terms and guidelines and will take immediate action if necessary. So, and then in the initial TechCrunch story, they were looking at Expedia, Hotels.com, and Hollister as a few examples of this. And like zoom way out. And to me, like, this is that, you know, the press has a pretty big role in driving like policy and enforcement. Like, Apple has the policies, the rules aren't changing. It's just they haven't been enforced. And, you know, this reporter at TechCrunch, Zach Whitaker, who specializes in security stories, like, you know, in the interest of writing a good story, investigated this happening and, you know, framed it in such a way that it looks like it's in violation of their rules. And so now it sounds like Apple will try and be more aggressive about this. But you know, again, based on what you say, it sounds like it's just that Apple's going to look at these specific apps now because TechCrunch wrote about them, and not that there's some systematic way of doing it otherwise. So.
Yeah, I can't think. And even if there was, I still go back to, it's not that different from them, you know, doing analytics logging where they're just writing it down in text form and then sending it to the server. Realistically, it's not that different. Right. Like, it is slightly worse and more encroaching on, you know, what you're doing, but it's not miles apart. It really isn't. So even if they did fully stop screen recording, you know, all these apps can still know exactly what you're doing. Mm. So, you know, practically, what's the difference?
This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. When you're young and just starting out on your own for the first time, or even if you've just never established a credit history before, it can feel daunting to overcome that. I've been there in college. That's where Upstart can help. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate in less than 2 minutes without affecting your credit score. The best part? Once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day, the next day. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or even just make a large purchase. So don't wait. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. Hurry to upstart.com/happyhour to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/happyhour. Our thanks to Upstart for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, the other big story this week is Angela Ahrendts leaving Apple in April and DJ O'Brien taking over her role, which is the senior vice president of retail at Apple, which is the Apple store and the Apple online store. And kind of came out of nowhere. And it's not that Angela is going somewhere else. She's just like leaving Apple and seems to be kind of going off into retirement. She is like in her late 50s. So like, it's not insane to not want a high level role anymore. And she came, 5 years ago from Burberry. She was the CEO of Burberry in London, the high fashion brand. And I think she had that job for about 6 or 7 or 8 years. So it wasn't that much longer than her 5 years in an Apple. It just kind of a story that came out of nowhere. Although in some ways it didn't, there was at least one report from an Italian Apple blog back in October or so that said it was coming. And it got some of the details wrong. It said that this person's sources told them that Angela was leaving possibly by the end of the year, and that the top retail person in Australia would take over. And that part didn't happen. But this story kind of came out of nowhere. Like, what's your take on this, Mayo?
Yeah. The statement says that Ahrendts is leaving to pursue personal and professional projects. So it doesn't say that she's retiring necessarily. So it does leave the door open for her to go and do other, you know, go and work at another company.
Yeah, I think the retiring bit comes from what people like Michael Stieber have heard that retail people have been told internally. That wasn't an outside statement, but just like what the chatter is from her to retail people, I think.
Yeah, there was also a quote, I think, from the Vogue Business Reporter that she hadn't gone back to England where her children are like studying, they've got careers now for a long time, and she was kind of missing that and stuff.
So, yeah, that was left out of the like published version, but was captured from the piece, which was, I think Vogue Business is like a wholly new publication of Vogue, and this is like their first ever cover story.
and then a month later she's out.
a week later she's out.
It's
really crazy. And a lot of the quotes were taken from that to say like, look, you know, she wants to go back into fashion. She doesn't like retail in this sense. There's so many aspects to this. Like, for a while, for reasons unknown, people were saying that Angela Ahrendts was like the successor to Tim Cook if he leaves or something, like, you know, she's the number two. People said that about Jeff Williams too. And I'm not sure how they make these decisions of like what they say, but there is no like outward facing succession that we can see. I think people said that because she was the CEO of Burberry. And I mean, leading Apple retail is like being the CEO of the Apple store. You know, it's the biggest part of Apple by people, at least.
And she didn't take a pay cut when she joined Apple because they matched her compensation.
There were years where through stock, I think she made more than Tim Cook did, right? Like,
multiple years. Like, her first year, because at Burberry, she was on set to receive like $67 million or something. Apple matched that when she joined. So she did take technically a lesser title because she didn't become CEO, but, you know, she was definitely paid well for her time.
Yeah. And hiring her was a the whole history there is like, the Apple store was created around 2000 and with Ron Johnson hired to lead the Apple store. And he did it for 10 years under Steve Jobs. And then, you know, Steve Jobs was sick. Ron Johnson left to become the CEO of JCPenney, a retailer in the US. And then he was later on fired from that job because it's a tough time for companies like JCPenney, and he didn't miraculously save them. So Tim Cook, like, one of his first tasks as, you know, replacing Steve Jobs, even in the interim, was to find someone new to run retail. And it was Peter Oppenheimer, I think, was he the CFO at the time, who took over retail like in between. But there were many, many months where there was no SVP of retail. And then Tim Cook picked John Browett, the CEO of Dixons in the UK, an electronics retailer. And that lasted a few months. There were like numerous New York Times columns about how conditions were pretty bad within Apple retail. People got raises.
He was cutting budgets. Yeah. He was telling people not to do support stuff.
All the good things that Apple stores are known for and that they kind of give away because it's good for business overall, he didn't like. If you couldn't put a number on it, a profit, then it was pretty bad. And like, if you were part-time, then you were like almost fired.
He lasted 6 months, I believe.
Yeah, there was a whole of the anonymous Twitter users or anonymous Apple employee staff on Twitter that used like funny accounts to vent about work. There was this whole campaign of fire hashtag fire John Browett. And his firing did happen, and it was tied with the dismissal of Scott Forstall. It was like a sub mention in the same press release of like increased collaboration by ousting Scott Forstall. And by the way, John Browett's going to be gone. But then like many months went by again with no one to replace him because he was that bad that he was like fired with no one.
A year and a half, I believe.
Yeah, ready. And then I guess it was like a whole process to find somebody. And then it was going to be Angela Lawrence, the CEO of Burberry, to leave that job to work at Apple. And then even after that, it was like this whole leap of like it's announced and then it hasn't happened for months yet. And her time at Apple, like it seems to have gone pretty smoothly, like from what I've seen. I'm not in retail, but a lot of Apple's in the news issues are being tied to her leaving now, and people are trying to say that Apple's missed revenue quarter, which again is their second, was the second biggest quarter ever. So they're still higher than the 2 year ago quarter, that she is gone now because Apple missed their revenue, you know, their guidance. And that she was opposed to doing sales. Like Apple's never done sales in stores, though. Like nothing that she's done is like radically different, and from what I can tell.
Yeah, what people have brought up is stuff like she got rid of the cashier checkout terminals where you could go and buy something at a location, but that's not true. Apple stores haven't had checkout terminals for like a decade or more, because they pioneered the whole walk around with like the iPod Touch with the you know card reader in the bottom, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there was like, oh, the whole come and do experiences at the Apple Store concept has backfired, so that wasn't good either. That's not true. I mean, they've been doing that before.
They've done Arend's free joined. Workshops where you can sign up online and show up for free, and like they would describe it as like a one to many experience. And then there was also a program where you paid $100 a year called One to One, where you got private versions of that. And they did end that under her, but I imagine it was because that program didn't scale very well. Like you couldn't pay enough people to do those programs. And it wasn't profitable.
But, and they brought so much of it back in the free sessions that they did with Today at Apple.
Yeah, Today at Apple's kind of just been like version 2.0 of all of that for free.
Yeah, it's not like a brand new direction. It was just a bigger scale version of it. Right. And then the other thing is like the stores are really overcrowded and you can never find someone to do something. But, I mean, that was true before Arend's joined as well. It's like, I don't know, everyone just loves to like ascribe blame for every problem they have with Apple at the moment onto the person that really gets fired. It's like the middle of last year, everyone was applauding Arend's like the best Apple employee ever and everyone loved her, and then she announces that she's going, and suddenly it's like, oh, I knew she was gonna be fired. Clearly the Apple stores were a mess. Like the cause and effect, I can't make the dots. I don't believe that she was fired on performance grounds. Like Tim Cook like tweeted, I'm really sorry to see Arend's go, she's done a great job here, we've got someone new now.
Bittersweet, and they had the word he used.
And they got the big you know congratulatory press statement where, you know, they applauded her time there. They even had her at the they gave her stage time at the October event, talked about Apple retail for 10 minutes, and that's all like relatively recent, right? I don't see all that and then think like, oh, they got rid of her because they didn't like what she was doing.
Like you would get rid of maybe the CFO or like someone in that chain.
Blaming her for the iPhone sale thing is ridiculous. Yeah. It's like,
and I've also saw coverage that connected things like Apple selling the Apple Watch Edition, the original gold version, for $10,000 to $17,000. As a her problem, like, and that it was, that she was in charge of the Apple stores whenever that was a thing, and that those watches didn't sell very well, and they were discontinued. It's like, she was brought on when the Apple Watch was like being pushed. You know, it's like, in no way was it her idea.
And yes, she came from fashion, but plenty of people inside of Apple retail come from fashion backgrounds. Like, way before Arend's was even involved, they would hire, you know, managers for the actual Apple stores, they'd always look for like Gap managers and stuff. They would never go for like tech company stuff because they want personable people. They don't want, you know, geeks and nerds like us.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, when I worked in Apple retail, like one of
the... what time period did you end Apple retail?
Like 2010 to 2012. And my direct manager was a former Gap manager, and above that person was like a former Circuit City manager, and it was like it was all retail.
Were you in the Broward era then?
Yeah, I saw Broward came through. I was in the my hiring certificate had like a signature from Ron Johnson, but he was gone already. It was just like recycled, and then there was, I guess, Peter Oppenheimer was like technically at the top, you know, under Tim Cook for Apple stores, but it was like there was no SVP at retail at the time. And then Brout was hired while I was there, and I think he was fired while I was there too. But I saw him in person. Like, he would come through to all the major stores, and he came through to our store to meet with like the top employees of our store and kind of just like get to know employees and all the stores that he was leading. And so I saw him walk through like while I was working one day, and I told a customer, "That's John Broward. He's the head of Apple stores," and they didn't care. But I did see him in person, like, you know, very British, you know, much like yourself. It's like, but it was also during the time when like there were, you know, you'd see negative stories about conditions at Apple stores, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was accredited to him, and, you know, you see schedule changes, and yeah, I was a part of the brunt that was felt, I guess.
Yeah, so I cannot accept that she was fired or let go because of not doing what Apple wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you agree with that, right?
Yeah, my sense from when I worked there was that people, you know, as far as like entry-level jobs, were hired based on personality, not from technical background. And like Tim Cook had a line on that, which was like, we've got, you know, hundreds of tech experts, we don't need that. We don't, you know, we've got that covered already. We need you. Talking about Angela Arendt, and it's, you know, you can learn the tech stuff on the job, and it changes every month, so you need to be trained on it regularly anyway. It's hiring people based on their personality in the store level, and then at a leadership level, you know, of course she was a good fit. She was a CEO of a retail brand, you know, of a retail chain, you know, and a fashion brand. But like, whether it was, you know, high fashion, low fashion, you know, I mean, even like Brout, like had the right resume leading, Dixon's or whatever. So
yeah.
His reason for being fired was that he was a bad cultural fit. They kind of later, he said at least, and in this case, like, there's no indication that she's fired. Like, people putting together the dots are just kind of, I think, imagining things. And
yeah, I think if they she left on bad terms, they wouldn't have given her such a applauding press release. Like,
yeah, and
it would be more like the Broward thing where she'd get like a sentence.
Yeah, and she's leaving in April, but the new person, DJ O'Brien, is already has her title too. So like right now there's two SVPs of Apple Retail according to the leadership page. And I think it's just that there's a smooth transition there, like, you know, that Deidre's already in charge, but she's, you know, slowly taking it over from Angela, and that Angela's, you know, being allowed, there may be something special about the stock in 5 years. And that, so she's allowed to stay through then, like as preferred, and it's not abrupt. The thing that is different here is that in the past, there have been long periods without someone in charge. So between Johnson to Broward and then Broward to Arendt, there were, like you said, months in between someone being in charge, and now there's no gap. But also, O'Brien is the first time ever that they've hired internally for someone to lead Apple Retail, because Johnson was hired to start it, and then Broward was brought in externally after a long search, and then Angela came in after a long search. And so this is the first time that Tim Cook, you know, looks to someone within Apple to lead, even though she wasn't directly in retail before.
Yeah, and DJ O'Brien is like Apple for life. She's been there for about 30 years. She was there for 10 years before Tim Cook joined the company. So she lived through the really bad eras of Apple Incorporated, yeah, like the bad 90s.
Yeah, I mean, that's my whole take on like why she was chosen at a high level, is that Tim Cook has been faced with this problem of like who to hire for Apple Retail, you know, to lead since he started as CEO. And, you know, 10 years later, however long it's been, like, it's still a challenge he's facing. And, you know, it's like 5 years was, you know, a good run for Angela, but it's still pretty short in what you'd expect someone to have that job for. You know, like,
Apple executives normally last longer than 5 years.
Yeah. Even if they get moved around, like they stay in leadership for longer than 5 years. And I think she's like 58, which is not old. I mean, like, you know, you could see another 5 years of the same job before she wanted to retire and just enjoy her money. But it does seem to be that, you know, she's got personal reasons for leaving, and that Tim Cook chose someone who's been, you know, all my life at Apple. And DJ O'Brien comes up, like, we didn't know her past a few years ago. Like, we'd never heard of her. And she was picked to be the VP of People in 2017, which was either new at the time or fairly recent. But there used to be, like, levels around inclusion and diversity, and HR was its own thing. And, like, VP of People was meant to kind of incorporate all that. And also
– yeah, because they had Denise Young for a while, and then she went – strictly to diversity, and then Deirdre took the people position.
Right, yeah. And the Denise Young Smith thing, that did seem to be an episode where there were, you know, unhappiness within, you know, leadership of, like, her role, and then she – I don't think she left on good terms. Like, there was a statement that she made that seemed to clash with what, like Tim Cook's values are. I think it, and it's complicated because it is about, like, race and diversity, but I think it was that her statement was something around a table full of, like, of white men could be just as diverse as a table of, like, mixed races, and that there's more to diversity than just, like, your race and your skin color, but it's, you know, like, your background, which I think is a very fair thing to say, but out of context, that got taken, you know, and turned about. And yeah. Apple had to, like, issue made her issue an apology about it, which I think is, like, one of those things where she believes in her heart, and then, you know, was made to apologize, and then a few months later she left, and it was like, that probably was not, like, goodbye on good terms, but just as the person in charge of diversity at Apple, like, it didn't fit their vision of what diversity is, which is, like, the numbers on a chart, you know, kind of thing, which is its own challenge.
And before being in People, O'Brien worked in operations as well, which is interesting. Because
yeah, she was a VP, like, not at the leadership page level, but a vice president of, like, worldwide sales. And so she was involved in, you know, making sure that things ran smoothly in sales. And then in an internal memo, Tim Cook says that she was involved at the launch of the first Apple stores and Apple online store. So it doesn't say, like, what level, but she at least touched those projects from what he says. So I think that's to kind of, like, tell people – it is weird that she's both what's HR at Apple, you know, human resources at Apple, and retail, like, you know, senior vice president retail, like, those should be different jobs.
Yeah, I don't think that's a stable equilibrium. Like, the permanent plan cannot be for her to do both things.
Like, there might be someone new come to HR, or I think what would look, like, rockier is if someone new comes to retail, because, like, you know, who cares in charge of HR, like, at a, you know, in terms of, like, looking at investment, that kind of thing. But,
My kind of, like, guess is that Arends didn't leave on bad terms, but maybe it was kind of a surprise that Apple expected her to stay on for longer, but sometime at the end of last year, you know, she received all her big stock options from when she joined. She was reconsidering, you know, what she's going to do, and then for whatever personal reason, she felt like she needed to leave. And so then they, she obviously communicated that with the company at, you know, somewhere around the latter half of 2018.
Yeah.
And then they were in a bit of a spot where Cook didn't want to have another repeat of, you know, a massive gap of no leadership at all, or, like, getting someone in on a rush and then having a repeat of the Broward mess. And so they've gone for something more, a quick fix in terms of they don't have to have a gap at all because they've hired from inside, and also arguably safer in that it is actually, someone that has been at Apple for life. So clearly there's more of a culture fit you'd expect than getting someone brand new. And clearly they've struggled in the past to find really good candidates because it took them a while to find Arends and it took them a while to find Broward and et cetera, et cetera. So it can't be like there's more of a dearth of, you know, people for the job.
Yeah. And DJ O'Brien clearly demonstrates to Tim Cook that she's willing to step up when she's needed and serve in a higher role for Apple. And, you know, I agree with you that this is just a matter of time until someone new takes over one of her jobs, HR or retail. And it's probably going to be HR because that position feels more like, it's less of a fuss, I guess, if someone new takes it. It's not that it's not important. It's very important. But that you want to have...
It's not as high profile, let's be honest.
Sure, right. And before she was the VP of People, not the SVP of People, that wasn't a senior level role. And retail has to be. So you could see the people part of her job falling down to someone that's at a VP level. So
The HR people don't get stage time. The retail people do. Like, yeah. It's just reality because retail is more of a product than, you know, retail is almost a product. It's like alongside hardware and software.
Yeah.
And I am excited to see what kind of fresh blood in retail will do. Not that I think that Arends did a bad job. Like, I think once the, you know, kind of craziness of this dies down, people won't look back and be like, oh yeah, Arends was the bad times. Like, clearly Brow, it was a black mark. Arends is not that. She clearly, you know, the new stores they do have incredible architecture and they look great. And, you know, product-wise, the arrangements are really, really good. She really expanded the Today at Apple program in a big way. And I think it's been, you know, pretty successful with them.
And in a way that fits Apple's culture, like, for forever, which is, you know, creativity and using the products, not just, like, that the products exist, but what can you actually do with them and mm-hmm. you know, encouraging people to do that.
Yeah. But I did not see any attempt through her, you know, reign, as it were, for them to address what I think is the biggest problem of the Apple retail store experience, which is overcrowding. Because
stores is the only thing they could do. They'll make bigger stores, but hire more people.
It doesn't make enough. Like, even the biggest store they have is still overcrowded. Like,
yeah, it turns out if you make the store bigger and hire more people, the more people show up at one time anyway.
Yeah, and they keep putting more, like, they, as well as being the store where you buy stuff, now they have massive Today at Apple sessions, so it just adds just more traffic into the room. Like, people are kind of like juggling around finding each other. And the overcrowding issue existed before Arends was there. She didn't manufacture it, but she didn't address it.
Yeah,
so
I do think they've made it harder to schedule a Genius Bar appointment. Like, you used to, you could go to your store's website and do it online, and they've made it harder to find that, which I think is a way to, like they show you things like calling first or using other authorized resellers or, you know, service providers first. And like coming to the store is like a last resort where it used to be like the first thing you'd see. Or at least there was like a direct page to it. Now there's not. And I think that's like part of an attempt to work on the crowd issue. And even things
even if you navigate like the phone tree to get to the eventual Genius Bar reservation page, it turns out they're all booked for a week, and then you have to like come back the next day and you know,
can't
check in
book
the morning
out 2 weeks later. And it's
it's problematic. Yeah. Like,
and those are constraints to try and minimize the problem, but it's not been effective yet. And there have been things like used to you could check in, but you had to be there to like wait the whole time, or you're out of luck. And they've done things like take your phone number and then text you when your appointment is a few minutes away. And those are like attempts to work on this problem, but they've not cracked it yet.
Yeah. And there's not a clear answer either, apart from, you know, like double the number of stores that exist or something. Like, maybe having an operations background, you know, Deirdre O'Brien might have some fresh ideas about how they can address these problems, because it's like the stores are great, but they're so full, it makes it worse. Like, they are really victims of their own success, whether it's, you know, in terms of support channel and the whole, you know, actually getting help, or just in terms of, you know, browsing and having fun in the store or whatever. Like, you know, I think the whole like town square, we're all going to meet up every day and, you know, hang around is kind of a silly goal, but, you know, you do the whole like having experiences in retail stores is a trend that the whole industry is doing. Like, as the high street kind of collapses, everyone is looking for ways to keep people into the, and have foot traffic and
bring someone,
you know,
in
do more than just
reason.
Have shelves.
Yeah, bring someone in for a different reason and then maybe sell them something while they're there. When you've got like online, which is going to be more convenient.
But right now you have the selling, you have the experience, and you have the support all happening in these stores that, you know, probably aren't big enough to only manage two of those things. Like, to me, that's the problem. And
it was the problem years ago too. And the only thing you can do is like shut the Genius Bar down and do it somewhere else, whether it's, you know, like every other company, which is like mail it in. But then you lose that value. And I think that would not be worth it. Like, it's a value people. And they leverage the Genius Bar to then turn you back into a customer in the rest of the Apple store. Like, if what you came for isn't economical to repair, then, you know, aside from the crowds, like, it's not a bad system. It's just crowd management is very difficult. And there are some times of the year that you'll find, whether it's a certain time of day or a certain time of year where it's like far enough from Christmas kind of thing, where those giant stores or even the smaller ones can be very empty. So you, you know, it's like you've got to, you can't just have like a 5-story Apple store for Christmas and then, you know, sell it off, you know, sell off three of the floors the rest of the year. Like it's tricky, but.
Yeah, I don't have an answer, but that is the, for me, that is by far the biggest problem. Like the whole, it's like everything sounds great and then you go there and it's so busy, it's like impossible. So. Yeah.
And like zoom way out again, and it's like there are obvious challenges that as a customer you face, like where are you supposed to go to pay? Unless you know how it works, it is different, so that it can be frustrating, and it can feel bad to need to be taught that. Like you can feel condescending to you know not know how a store works when it's different than every other retail store. So,
or like buy an accessory without having to talk to anybody at all, kind of feels, you know, weird. Even if you know that's what you're supposed to do, it still kind of feels socially
and
odd.
And these are all like pre-Angela Arndt's problems that remain today. And during like Christmas time, they have like an express lane for checkout, which feels really good when you can just like, you know where to go and pay as a customer. But I guess they just don't want to do that the rest of the year because of the way it looks or something. I don't know.
And again, if the store's one is busy, it would be easier to find people that can help you. Like it all comes back to just being so full. It breaks down. Like, you know why people want actual checkouts is because then there can be a line where people just queue up. And right now it's just like a madhouse because everyone's everywhere. But if the stores had less footfall, everything that they were doing would work better. And I'll give you another example of like weird kind of breakdown is the iPhone battery program. Obviously, the battery program has nothing to do with retail itself, but the actual like, you know, you want to get a new battery, you have to go to a retail store. That's their recommended route. People would make reservations online for, I want an iPhone battery replacement. And then they'd get to the store at their allotted time slot. And then the Genius people would tell them, we've run out of batteries. Like, that's a problem. Like, if you're doing reservations for exact issues, then surely they should have enough stock to cover those things. Like, that is a kind of blurs the line between like the Apple support, Apple Care side and Apple retail, but it's definitely a retail problem because, you know, they do support in the retail store. So those kind of issues are like the retail stores are fine, but they're not perfect. Like they have plenty of problems and it's nothing. There's still nothing that's like any, you know, Arendt did something really wrong.
There were some things where I think her taste did apply to the store and improve them. Like in many ways, like the fact that they have bigger and new stores that are redesigned and much nicer looking is like, you know, a trajectory for Apple anyway. And that they've got experts, like whether she was there or not, I think that some of the stuff would have happened. But then there were things like weekly video messages that, you know, I don't know if people liked them or not, but at the surface, like that sounds like a nice idea for showing every employee that you're there working. And there were things like changing the style of shirts from the center Big Apple blue shirts, which were kind of dated, to more subtle apples like over the heart, which looked more like just like a fashion brand. You know, like those just kind of looked nicer. And she got rid of the name tags, which was like, it's kind of it's small things that were like tasteful, you know. So no longer do you have a lanyard with your name on it and like, you know, some goofy logo, like a fake iPhone.
Yeah, and the retail like architecture side has definitely shifted from popping up like stalls in malls and small stalls like that to only doing like these massive flagship stuff. So that is a marked difference.
Yeah, well, malls are closing too. Like in the 80s, malls were popular and now malls are closing and like open area shopping is preferred.
At some point, Apple's just going to buy a mall.
The Apple Mall. And another change is like when I was brand new, and I remember reading a 9to5 Mac story written by Mark Gurman at the time, which was that Apple was going to roll out smart signs. He called it like Apple Retail 2.0, and they were going to use iPads to be the signage for products. And you can tap through and learn about the product in front of you and tap a button to have someone come help you and see the prices. It made a lot of sense. But they were problematic because people thought that the iPads, like if you were a customer coming to buy an iPad at the Apple store and you wanted to learn about the iPad, you might go to the iPad smart sign by the Mac and try and like use that iPad to like learn about it. But really it was just the iPad being used as a sign. And if you want the iPad experience, it was another table where iPads were like loose and could be held and, you know, used. And the buttons to get help were problematic because people wouldn't stay by them. And, you know, it wasn't a great system. So, one of her early moves was to replace the smart signs by, an app on the device. So it would have like a prices app, and it would be like on the top right window and running on the Mac or iOS or whatever. Yeah. And learn about the product on the product itself. And it looked better because you didn't have these iPads like glued into the table and acrylic cases. So, I've never worked under Angela Arendt, but it externally, like having experience in Apple stores and seeing, there definitely wasn't a fire Angela Arendt movement like there was for John Browett. I'll say that. And it doesn't hurt that the new person in charge, H.R. Bryan, has a history, in the sales chain when Apple has the current challenges that they have right now, which is, you know, how to sell more iPhones. Like, it's not the reason, but it doesn't hurt. You know, it may be a reason that she is tapped to be the replacement versus someone else internally or externally. But I definitely don't see this as like Angela's fired, the new person comes in because they've got sales experience and they're going to be willing to do more with promotions that Angela and anyone before her wasn't willing to do, you know.
Yeah, like maybe Angela left because she hated all those ugly signs popping up saying trade in your current phone for an iPhone XR.
It's crazy. This week, 95 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by LinkedIn Jobs. The right hire can make a huge impact on your business. At 95 Mac, we're a small team, so one bad hire can throw a wrench in everyone's workflow. On the flip side, hiring the right person, which isn't always easy, has positive effects for the whole team. That's why it's so important to find the right person. But where do you find that individual? You can post a job on a job board and hope you find the right person. But think about it. How often do you hang out on job boards? Don't leave finding someone great to chance when you can post your job to a place where people go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover job opportunities. LinkedIn. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited the top job boards, but 9 out of 10 members are open to new opportunities. And with 70% of the U.S. workforce on LinkedIn, posting on LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of more of the right people. People who are qualified for your role and ready for something new. It's the best way to find the person who will help you grow your business. And why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. Hurry to linkedin.com/happyhour and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/happyhour. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, finally this week, we've got the second iOS 12.2 beta, which brings a few changes from the first beta version. iOS 12.2 is largely about supporting HomeKit TVs in the Home app. But then there's some new stuff that we've got this week, which is there are new Animoji. Would you know that there's a shark, there's a giraffe, and there's an owl. Would you know the name of the last animal like on your own?
Yeah.
Okay, warthog.
Yeah, because to me it's like Hakuna Matata from the
Lion
King.
The
Lion King.
You wouldn't know the name of the movie.
I would immediately known what it was called. Yeah.
Now, I was thinking like Jeff Benjamin wrote a story on this. I'm not sure I would have known the name of warthog by looking at it. Like pig with horns. What is that called again? But yeah, warthog. What do you think about the new Animoji?
They're cool. I think the shark is a miss. And this is kind of like in the weeds, but all of the other Animoji focus on the face, and it makes sense because you animate them with your face. Like that's what the Face ID sensor does with it, and the camera sensors. They respond to your emotions, and you get this kind of like bubbly charm where it's cartoony, but it's still realistic. Like you can interpret the people's expressions through them. They're not going for human realism, but through the cartoonish impact, you get the face, you get, you know, if people are smiling or crying or sticking their tongue out even nowadays. The shark kind of ignores making the face dynamic enough to show its body, and even like its tail always flaps left and right, and it's a lot more zoomed out, and It's almost just like they ran out of polygons to animate the face properly, because it's a lot more bland, and it just kind of like moves around a bit. And even if you look at it in the grid, it kind of sticks out, because all of the others are zoomed in crops of, you know, portraits of the animals or the object or the robot or whatever, actual face. And then the shark in the grid is looks a lot smaller because they've actually fit his whole body in. And to me, that's the one that they shouldn't have done, or they should have done it differently to actually... It doesn't fit the set of Animoji. Like, it feels more crummy. Like, doesn't feel great.
To me, the shark was the one that stood out, because as a dad, the song Baby Shark is stuck in my head for life, and that was a reason to play with that Animoji. At a high level,
I'll be honest, when I saw the shark one, for me, that felt like a Samsung emoji. Like, it's like, we just got this 3D model, and then we made it, we strung it up with a skeleton that you can kind of animate around. Like,
I think it's that bad, but...
I don't know, it doesn't... I wouldn't have included it if it was my decision.
It is nice to see in a point update more Animoji come still after the first iPhone X introduced them, and it's also nice on the iPad where you've got a much bigger canvas. You need more Animoji to fill up the Animoji app, because it's kind of blank when you've got, you know, just a dozen. I think there's 24 in total now, and then you've also got like unlimited number of Memoji. Did you see the billboard ads for the Grammy nominated artists for Apple Music?
Yeah.
Those are really creepy. Like, they've got Memoji versions of the artists who are nominated for Grammys on billboards in like LA, for example. And
yeah, like Shawn Mendes and Ariana Grande.
Yeah, they look they're like in between like fake and real, and it's kind of uncomfortable to see. But
they kind of remind me of like Japanese anime, kind of weird. Yeah.
So new Animoji. You also
Giraffe. The giraffe is my favorite. The giraffe is really well done.
You like the giraffe the most? Okay.
Yeah.
If I had to go just on appearance, I think the owl is like the most charming of the new four. I guess the warthog gets no favorites here, but the
warthog and the owl are kind of like direct siblings to the current set. Mm. The giraffe and the shark kind of go more out there, because obviously the giraffe incorporates its neck.
Yeah, long and neck, then, and then the body.
Yeah, and then you get like the whole kind of body of the shark. Yeah. The giraffe really works. That for me, the shark doesn't.
Yeah, the poop Animoji is still the best one. Smiling poop Animoji. It's so weird, like, to write about it and talk about it. It's like there's also a poop Animoji, a smiling pile of poop, which is just because of like the original emoji set. You know,
Have you sent any Animojis recently before, like trying out the beta?
Last time was around Christmas, you know, during a Santa Claus Animoji. But no, I've not. Well, I guess I made some air power jokes with Animoji too, but I think I've used my Memoji for that more than Animoji.
Yeah, I don't reuse them either, but I think for like high schoolers and stuff, I actually think people do actually send them, because I see people doing it, which surprises me.
I take it back. I used one in FaceTime a week ago, like organically, not as like a for work kind of thing. I was
talking. The FaceTime, they're almost cooler in FaceTime because they overlay onto your actual video.
Yeah, you don't have the limit of like 20, 30 seconds or whatever. And
yeah,
it was.
And they've definitely paid for their investment in, you know, like the Twitter memes of everyone doing covers and stuff, because they still come up on Twitter every now and again in like TikTok, and then, you know, the cool side of the internet. Like, people love doing the Memoji covers of like songs and stuff.
Yeah, I was using my professional iPad to FaceTime my sister's newborn baby, because she's a couple months old now, and you know, not a lot you can say on FaceTime to a baby, so I used the monkey emoji just to, you know, make monkey sounds, and seemed to win her over. So that was a good organic use of Animoji on my professional iPad. It's great that they're there on the iPad Pro. And, it's like, I think they make the most sense on the iPhone XR, because it's like, that's like the consumer, like, you know, mainstream phone. But it was funny, like last year it was only on the $1,000 iPhone, and like this year on the iPad, it's only on the iPad Pro. But like, even though it isn't like a pro feature, it's just because of Face ID. And on my daughter's non iPad Pro, she's got like a few Animoji ripoff apps, because she always wants to, you know, participate. And then those are just like terrible. They send you alerts and you've got to turn it off, and they probably, you know, record your screen and all kinds of stuff. They're bad. Also new in the beta, the AirPlay icon on the control center tile for like what's now playing, that you tap to change like to AirPods or like an AirPlay 2 speaker, or just like a Bluetooth speaker for that matter. It used to be like this like corner circle of like two, you know, beams or something. I don't know what it tried to be.
Yeah, like wavy lines.
Yeah. And it was like put there to be the fast faster way to pick AirPods or something. Like, I mean, I remember there was like a season of like complaining about how hard it was to get to AirPods with that design. And then they added that little button and it made it a little bit easier. Now it's not a, you know, quarter of a circle. It's now, in the AirPlay icon, like the triangle and the circles. And it's got a really nice animation. And it changes to the classic AirPlay icon, which is now just used for video, which is like the triangle and the rectangle, which is now meant to be like a TV. And like it'll change dynamically based on like what you're doing. So if you're playing audio or if you're playing video and you want to beam it somewhere. And I've noticed during the tvOS 2.2 beta that like if I'm just like playing something on the TV, my control center tile for that becomes the active one with that icon in the corner. So like if I'm watching a movie on iTunes, for example, on the Apple TV, that tile changes. Or in the case of like, you know, having the TV be tied into I guess HomeKit now, it'll change if you're like, I think if you're like watching like the YouTube app, for example, and then you've got quick access to like skip forward and backwards and, you know, seek and that kind of thing.
Kind of like how it worked on the watch before, where the now playing would automatically show if it recognized you interacting with the TV. And
that's right. And it's less annoying because it's there when you need it, but it's not like taking over the whole screen.
Yeah.
It does show up on your lock screen a lot more now too, which is meant to be convenient. And so that can be good or bad depending on what you want to see in your lock screen. But to me, like replacing the watch face is annoying, but like putting it as a tile somewhere that you've got to go and find is not as kind of handy. And they both have really nice animations that you can see in the beta, and I've tweeted them and put them in the post coverage. So the other thing is, if you have an AT&T iPhone, or iPad, say the iPad of a certain generation, I guess the newer phones count, and you're in like one of, I think they say 400 markets, you'll see your carrier, your network change, not the carrier name, but the network type that you're using change from LTE to 5G space E, which was controversial like back in November, December, because like The Verge was among some sites that picked up the fact that AT&T was going to put this on Android phones to be like fake 5G before real 5G came to phones and networks. And, you know, the thinking was that Apple would never put 5GE on their phones because there's no such thing as 5GE. It's just an AT&T invented marketing term to describe like three different technologies that are not 5G yet. And it's 5G evolution, but LTE is long-term evolution. And it's like they say it's to mean that they're getting to 5G and that it's faster than LTE. But, and the places I've seen, I don't have it where I live, I have AT&T. But the places that do have it, the people I've asked, like, what are your speeds? They're not incredible. Like, they're the same as LTE speeds because it's all in theory, not like in practice.
You're not getting a faster speed.
Right.
Like, it's the same service as you got yesterday, but now you get a different icon for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever there's a history of this, like when AT&T moved the iPhone, for example, from, There was Edge, there was 3G, which are, you know, 2G and 3G. And then 4G was coming, and we knew that to be LTE. But then AT&T used HSPA Plus to mean 4G. And I think that's used by your carrier too, right?
Yeah, in the UK, we have a 4G symbol on our phones to mean HSPA Plus, mm-hmm. i.e. fast 3G.
Yeah.
And then the same 4G symbol can also mean actual LTE.
Okay, so
thanks to UK carrier marking.
And in the US with AT&T, and I think with everybody else, like no one else had HSPA Plus to mean 4G, or 4G to mean HSPA Plus. They just went from 3G to LTE, I think. But AT&T at least, because that's who I've had the whole time, has been, you had a 3G phone, you did a software update, and you had a 4G phone. Like, but then you didn't get a 4G phone until you had LTE. And it was just, if it worked with HSPA Plus, it would show you 4G, and then they didn't reuse 4G to mean LTE. They just sell LTE, and we're in the same boat now with 5G. And 5GE is like, you know, I think people are saying like maybe they'll use like NR to mean, I think it stands for new radio or something like that, for like true 5G. And the whole thing is that Apple isn't expected to do 5G in an iPhone until like 2020 at the soonest, because like
it's looking like 5G won't be deployed until 2020 at the soonest.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a whole race to deploy 5G among the carriers, but then they're using methods like, they've done in the past of calling things 5G that aren't really. And, you know, it's not that you're seeing your speeds increase. It's just the marketing. And it's kind of a surprise that Apple, like, allowed this to happen with 5G.
But they've done it before.
Yeah, I mean, they did it with 4G. And so here we go. But to me, that was like, I mean, it was pretty bad. But if they just called it 5G, but they made up a thing. They had to add the E to it. And
yeah, I care less that it's deceptive and more it's just ugly. Like, the 5G space E looks uglier in the status bar than if it just said 5G.
Yeah. If it, I was, you know, saying on Twitter, like, for example, if it just meant that your phone worked with the 4x4 MIMO stuff, like, the reason that you've got 6 antenna lines instead of 4 is because the XS and XS Max and the new iPad Pros can all do, they can work with a faster class of LTE, I think.
Yeah, not the 10R.
Yeah, not the 10R. But I think what we've seen is that 5GE means three different things, including MIMO, the 4x4 MIMO stuff. And so it extends to the 10R too and some other devices. So
and iPads. And
yeah, so it's not just that they're saying 5GE means that you get to work with the new 4x4 MIMO stuff. And
yeah, I think if they were being more... trying to be fairer, it would be labeled as like LTE Plus, because that's really what it is, not 5GE, which makes no sense at all. But
yeah, like I would not mind a newer label for your LTE is faster in this market than the one over there, because we've got faster technology here, and you're using it. Like LTE Plus would make perfect sense, or even like 4G Plus, whatever, 4GE. But you know, because as someone who's not in one of the markets that gets the 5GE stuff, I do appreciate that there's stuff in some markets and not others, and I'm not in one of the faster ones. But it's how they've labeled it with a stupid name, 5GE. Like you said, it's ugly.
I don't know why people are so surprised though that like Apple did this, because history shows they've done it before. And if you go even slightly further back, Apple has lied in the status bar about reception as well, because the whole a part of the antenna gate nonsense was that the antenna bars would optimistically show you having 4 or 5 bars, when in percentage terms, you only had 20% signal. So even Apple has fake stuff in that bar from time to time. So, like, they're not innocent in that regard.
I had 5GE FOMO, because I have no 5GE. But then people showed me their speeds, and it's like, oh, now I really don't care. Like, you're seeing virtually the same speeds as me in my LTE market. It's just a matter of, like, location. So,
And while we're talking about the status bar, can you confirm iOS 12.2, you're on a XS Max, in your top left on the lock screen, does it still say AT&T WIF?
It's still a scrolling text bar that says AT&T Y-F, and then it scrolls by to give you the rest of it. Although there's enough space to put the whole thing. Yeah.
Please fix that. Yeah. It's stupid.
Yeah. There's also this bug that shows you, it replaces the date on the lock screen with the percentage charge status of your phone, which you know we were upset about, and then they documented it as a known bug, and so it'll change in a future version. I've gotten kind of used to that. It's weird.
It's annoying me. Yeah. I like seeing the date.
Yeah, I've gotten used to seeing. I was like, oh, my phone is 30% charged. I need to charge it or something. You know.
Obviously this is a bug, but if they want to offer battery percentage, they should just give a setting that changes the glyph in the status bar to a number.
Yeah, instead of the icon, because the icon no one can perceive to be anything unless it's red.
And this has been a complaint since the iPhone X came out. A lot of people like to know their exact battery percentage, and to do it at the moment, you have to, you know, swipe down to the control center. Mm-hmm. But they could very easily offer a toggle, because obviously they used to offer a toggle where you could turn battery percentage on and off. And so now in the slightly, you know, in the notch world, they could offer a toggle that replaces the icon with a number instead, but they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Back on the 5GE thing, like, I think realistically, what you go from is 5GE to 5G.
Yep.
And that's confusing. I mean, that's why people are the most upset, is because it's like confusing marketing that is going to make consumers confused. But I would predict
carriers do something that confuses consumers.
I would predict that's what we see is 5GE to 5G, which is quite the revolution. All right, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you are
BZA Mayo.
And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.